Chapter 26. Struggle against those twin galleries of the human heart, low birth and iron fortune. Again, another's taste will lead him to the contemplation of Rienzi and the streets of Rome, another's to the rebuilt and repeopled streets of Pompeii, another's to the touching history of the fireside, where the Caxton family learned how to discipline their natures and tame their wild hopes down. But, however various their feelings and reasons may be, I am sure that with one accord each will help the other, and all will swell the greeting with which I shall now propose to you the health of our chairman, Sir Edward Bulwer Lytton. Speech. Sanitary Reform. London, May 10, 1851. The members and friends of the Metropolitan Sanitary Association dined together on the above evening at Gore House, Kensington. The Earl of Carlisle occupied the chair. Mr. Charles Dickens was present, and in proposing the Board of Health, made the following speech. There are very few words for me to say upon the needfulness of sanitary reform, or the consequent usefulness of the Board of Health. That no man can estimate the amount of mischief grown in dirt, that no man can say the evil stops here or stops there, either in its moral or physical effects, or can deny that it begins in the cradle, and is not at rest in the miserable grave, is as certain as it is that the air from Gin Lane will be carried by an easterly wind into Mayfair, or that the furious pestilence raging in St. Giles no mortal list of lady patronesses can keep out of Almack's. 15 years ago some of the valuable reports of Mr. Chadwick and Dr. Southwood Smith, strengthening and much enlarging my knowledge, made me earnest in this cause in my own sphere, and I can honestly declare that the use I have since that time made of my eyes and nose have only strengthened the conviction that certain sanitary reforms must precede all other social remedies, and that neither education nor religion can do anything useful until the way has been paved for their ministrations by cleanliness and decency. I do not want authority for this opinion. You have heard the speech of the Right Reverend Prelate 27, this evening, a speech which no sanitary reformer can have heard without emotion. Of what avail is it to send missionaries to the miserable man condemned to work in a fetid court, with every sense bestowed upon him for his health and happiness turned into a torment, with every month of his life adding to the heap of evils under which he is condemned to exist? What human sympathy within him is that instructor to address? What natural old chord within him is he to touch? Is it the remembrance of his children? A memory of destitution, of sickness, of fever, and of scrofula? Is it his hopes, his latent hopes of immortality? He is so surrounded by and embedded in material filth, that his soul cannot rise to the contemplation of the great truths of religion. Or if the case is that of a miserable child bred and nurtured in some noisome loathsome place, untempted, in these better days, into the ragged school, what can a few hours' teaching effect against the ever-renewed lesson of a whole existence? But give them a glimpse of heaven through a little of its light and air, give them water, help them to be clean, lighten that heavy atmosphere in which their spirits flag and in which they become the callous things they are. Take the body of the dead relative from the close room in which the living live with it, and where death, being familiar, loses its awe, and then they will be brought willingly to hear of him whose thoughts were so much with the poor, and who had compassion for all human suffering. The toast which I have to propose, the Board of Health, is entitled to all the honor which can be conferred upon it. We have very near us, in Kensington, a transparent illustration that no very great thing can ever be accomplished without an immense amount of abuse being heaped upon it. In connection with the Board of Health, we are always hearing a very large word which is always pronounced with a very great relish, the word centralization. Now I submit that in the time of the cholera we had a pretty good opportunity of judging between this so-called centralization and what I may, I think, call vestrilization. I dare say the company present have read the reports of the cholera Board of Health, and I dare say they have also read reports of certain vestries. I have the honor of belonging to a constituency which elected that amazing body, the Marylebone Vestry, and I think that, if the company present will look to what was done by the Board of Health at Glasgow, and then contrast those proceedings with the wonderful cleverness with which affairs were managed at the same period by my vestry, there will be very little difficulty in judging between them. My vestry even took upon itself to deny the existence of cholera as a weak invention of the enemy, and that denial had little or no effect in staying the progress of the disease. We can now contrast what centralization is as represented by a few noisy and interested gentlemen, and what centralization is when worked out by a body combining business habits, sound medical and social knowledge, and an earnest sympathy with the sufferings of the working classes. Another objection to the Board of Health is conveyed in a word, not so large as the other, delay. I would suggest, in respect to this, that it would be very unreasonable to complain that a first-rate chronometer didn't go when its master had not wounded up. The Board of Health may be excellently adapted for going, and very willing, and anxious to go, and yet may not be permitted to go by reason of its lawful master having fallen into a gentle slumber, and forgotten to set it a going. One of the speakers this evening has referred to Lord Castlereagh's caution, not to halloo until they were out of the wood. As regards the Board of Trade, I would suggest that they ought not to halloo until they are out of the woods and forests. In that leafy region the Board of Health suffers all sorts of delays, and this should always be borne in mind. With the toast of the Board of Health I will couple the name of a noble Lord Ashley, of whose earnestness in works of benevolence no man can doubt, and who has the courage on all occasions to face the cant which is the worst and commonest of all the cant about the cant of philanthropy. Speech. Gardening. London, June 9, 1851. At the anniversary dinner of the Gardeners' Benevolent Institution, held under the presidency of Mr., afterwards Sir Joseph Paxton, Mr. Charles Dickens made the following speech. I feel an unbounded and delightful interest in all the purposes and associations of gardening. Probably there is no feeling in the human mind stronger than the love of gardening. The prisoner will make a garden in his prison, and cultivate his solitary flower in the chink of a wall. The poor mechanic will string his scarlet bean from one side of his window to the other, and watch it, and tend it with unceasing interest. It is a holy duty in foreign countries to decorate the graves of the dead with flowers, and here too, the resting places of those who have passed away from us will soon be gardens. From that old time, when the Lord walked in the garden in the cool of the evening, down to the day when a poet laureate sang, trust me, Clara Vere de Vere, from yon blue heaven above us bent the gardener Adam, and his wife smile at the claims of long descent. At all times and in all ages gardens have been amongst the objects of the greatest interest to mankind. There may be a few, but I believe they are but a few, who take no interest in the products of gardening, except perhaps in London pride, or a certain degenerate kind of stock, which is apt to grow hereabouts, cultivated by a species of frozen-out gardeners whom no thaw can ever penetrate. Except these, the gardener's art has contributed to the delight of all men in their time. That there ought to be a benevolent, provident institution for gardeners is in the fitness of things, and that such an institution ought to flourish, and does flourish, is still more so. I have risen to propose to you the health of a gentleman who is a great gardener, and not only a great gardener, but a great man, the growth of a fine Saxon root cultivated up with a power of intellect to a plant that is at this time the talk of the civilized world. I allude, of course, to my friend the chairman of the day. I took occasion to say at a public assembly hard by, a month or two ago, in speaking of that wonderful building Mr. Paxton has designed for the great exhibition in Hyde Park, that it ought to have fallen down, but that it refused to do so. We were told that the glass ought to have been all broken, the gutters all choked up, and the building flooded, and that the roof and sides ought to have been blown away. In short, that everything ought to have done what everything obstinately persisted in not doing. Earth, air, fire, and water all appear to have conspired together in Mr. Paxton's favor, all have conspired together to one result, which, when the present generation is dust, will be an enduring temple to his honor, and to the energy, the talent, and the resources of Englishmen. But, said a gentleman to me the other day, no doubt Mr. Paxton is a great man, but there is one objection to him, that you can never get over, that is, he is a gardener. Now that is our case tonight, that he is a gardener, and we are extremely proud of it. This is a great age, with all its faults, when a man by the power of his own genius and good sense can scale such a daring height as Mr. Paxton has reached, and composedly place his form on the top. This is a great age, when a man impressed with a useful idea can carry out his project without being imprisoned, or thumbscrewed, or persecuted in any form. I can well understand that you, to whom the genius, the intelligence, the industry, and the achievements of our friend are well known, should be anxious to do him honor by placing him in the position he occupies tonight, and I assure you, you have conferred great gratification on one of his friends in permitting him to have the opportunity of proposing his health, which that friend now does most cordially and with all the honors. Speech. The Royal Academy Dinner. London, May 2, 1870. On the occasion of the second exhibition of the Royal Academy in their new galleries in Piccadilly, the President, Sir F. Grant, and the Council gave their usual inaugurative banquet, and a very distinguished company was present. The dinner took place in the large central room, and covers were laid for 200 guests. The Prince of Wales acknowledged the toast of his health and that of the Princess. The Duke of Cambridge responded to the toast of the army, Mr. Childers to the navy, Lord Elcho to the volunteers, Mr. Motley to the prosperity of the United States, Mr. Gladstone to Her Majesty's ministers, the Archbishop of York to the guests, and Mr. Dickens to literature. The last toast having been proposed in a highly eulogistic speech, Mr. Dickens responded, Mr. President, Your Royal Highnesses, my lords and gentlemen, I beg to acknowledge the toast with which you have done me the great honor of associating my name. I beg to acknowledge it on behalf of the Brotherhood of Literature, present and absent, not forgetting an illustrious wanderer from the fold, whose tardy return to it, we all hail with delight, and who now sits, or lately did sit within a few chairs of her on your left hand. I hope I may also claim to acknowledge the toast on behalf of the Sisterhood of Literature also, although that better half of human nature, to which Mr. Gladstone rendered his graceful tribute, is unworthily represented here, in the present state of its rights and wrongs, by the devouring monster, man. All the arts, and many of the sciences, bear witness that women, even in their present oppressed condition, can attain to quite as great distinction, and can attain to quite as lofty names as men. Their emancipation, as I am given to understand, drawing very near, there is no saying how soon they may push us from our stools at these tables, or how soon our better half of human nature, standing in this place of mine, may eloquently depreciate mankind, addressing another better half of human nature sitting in the president's chair. The literary visitors of the Royal Academy tonight desire me to congratulate their hosts on a very interesting exhibition, in which risen excellence supremely asserts itself, and from which promise of a brilliant succession in time to come is not wanting. They naturally see with especial interest the writings and persons of great men, historians, philosophers, poets, and novelists, vividly illustrated around them here. And they hope that they may modestly claim to have rendered some little assistance towards the production of many of the pictures in this magnificent gallery. for without the patient labors of some among them an historic history might have long survived in this place, and but for the researches and wandering of others among them, the most preposterous countries, the most impossible peoples, and the absurdest superstitions, manners, and customs, might have usurped the place of truth upon these walls. Nay, there is no knowing, Sir Francis Grant, what unlike portraits you yourself might have painted, if you had been left, with your sitters, to idle pens, unchecked reckless rumors, and undenounced lying malevolence. I cannot forbear, before I resume my seat, adverting to a sad theme the recent death of Daniel McLise, to which His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales made allusion, and to which the President referred with the eloquence of genuine feeling. Since I first entered the public lists, a very young man indeed, it has been my constant fortune to number amongst my nearest and dearest friends members of the Royal Academy who have been its grace and pride. They have so dropped from my side one by one that I already begin to feel like the Spanish monk of whom Wilkie tells, who had grown to believe that the only realities around him were the pictures which he loved, and that all the moving life he saw, or ever had seen, was a shadow and a dream. For many years I was one of the two most intimate friends, and most constant companions of the late Mr. McLise. Of his genius in his chosen art I will venture to say nothing here, but of his prodigious fertility of mind and wonderful wealth of intellect, I may confidently assert that they would have made him, if he had been so minded, at least as great a writer as he was a painter. The gentlest and most modest of men, the freshest as to his generous appreciation of young aspirants, and the frankest and largest-hearted, as to his peers, incapable of a sordid or ignoble thought, gallantly sustaining the true dignity of his vocation, without one grain of self-ambition, wholesomely natural at the last, as at the first, in wit a man, simplicity a child, no artist, of whatsoever denomination, I make bold to say, ever went to his rest leaving a golden memory more pure from dross, or having devoted himself with a truer chivalry to the art goddess whom he worshipped. These were the last public words of Charles Dickens. Footnotes. 1. Sir David Wilkie died at sea, on board the Oriental, off Gibraltar, on the 1st of June, 1841, whilst on his way back to England. During the evening of the same day his body was committed to the deep. Ed. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.